Today is Thursday, October 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump's illness puts a heavy focus on the vice presidential debate showdown Wednesday night.
An updated warning from the Centers for Disease Control,
acknowledging on Monday that the virus can sometimes spread through airborne particles that can linger in the air for minutes or even hours.
As cases of COVID-19 surge in many parts of the world, one continent is being praised for its response. And could the pandemic forever change the way people and companies work? It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump's battle with COVID-19, his age, and the age of his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, provided an unusual backdrop to Wednesday night's debate between Vice President Mike Pence and Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris. Pence and Harris took the stage at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, separated by plastic barriers for a 90-minute debate. It was a reminder of how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the race ahead of the November 3rd election. The televised clash came at a precarious moment for the Trump-Pence re-election campaign, less than a week after President Donald Trump announced he contracted the coronavirus amid a White House outbreak that has infected numerous high-profile Republicans. The White House National Security Advisor says there's evidence that foreign governments are tampering with the U.S. presidential election. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien says the United States will not tolerate any election interference from foreign countries, telling his Russian counterpart to stay out of the November election. O'Brien, at a security summit in Salt Lake City, says the Russians told him they weren't planning to interfere, but there's already evidence that they have. He says there are signs China, Iran, and some other countries that he wouldn't name are also meddling in U.S. politics. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in an updated guidance this week, says COVID-19 can spread through airborne transmission a month after it took down a similar warning. This report, produced by Yahira Jaquez.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention updated its guidance again on how coronavirus can be transmitted, acknowledging on Monday that the virus can sometimes spread through airborne particles that can linger in the air for minutes or even hours. The update comes after the agency sparked confusion last month when it published guidance warning the virus can spread through the air and then abruptly removed it, saying it was posted in error. The new guidance acknowledges reports that showed circumstances where people with COVID-19 infected others who were more than 6 feet away, according to the agency. In these instances, the CDC said the transmission occurred in poorly ventilated and enclosed areas that often involved activities that caused heavier breathing, such as singing or exercise. Despite its acknowledgement of airborne transmission, the agency said it is much more common for the virus to spread through close contact. Though also on Monday, a group of U.S. scientists warned in an unrelated open letter published in the medical journal Science that aerosols lingering in the air could be a major source of COVID-19 transmission.
Africa's response to COVID-19 has gained global recognition for its fast and targeted action. The Africa Centers for Disease Control has helped direct the continent's 54 countries into an alliance praised for responding better than some richer countries, including the United States. Africa has registered 37,000 deaths since the first case was announced, compared to more than 210,000 in the U.S. Health experts weigh in on what's behind the response, as Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
In late February, after Egypt confirmed Africa's first COVID-19 cases, John Nkangasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control, called a high-level meeting of health ministers. More than 40 ministers from around the continent scrambled to Addis Ababa on February 22nd. Nigeria's health minister, Osagie Ehanire, even changed his schedule while on a trip to Europe to be present. Within days, Nkangasong tells VOA in an interview, Africa CDC had produced the Africa Joint Continental Strategy for COVID-19, a blueprint to coordinate government action to combat the coronavirus. Zimbabwe, which had not yet confirmed its first case, preemptively implemented a full state of emergency that restricted flights and large gatherings. In South Africa, a lockdown was implemented on March 27 before even 1,000 COVID-19 cases had been recorded. Nkengasong says case numbers in places like South Africa could have been more than twice as high if such drastic action hadn't been taken.
That momentum that we had developed in Addis Ababa became the galvanizing force for countries to do what we have agreed on. COVID-19 crisis has exposed the divisions that exist in the world and then but also exposed the unity on the continent. I think the continent has come together more than I've ever seen in my 30 years of public health practice.
While Nkengasong says factors such as climate conditions, the average age of citizens, genetics and antibodies from pre-existing infections may have led to a lower number of deaths, the sense of urgency back in February also contributed. In June, the Africa CDC launched a joint procurement platform so governments can get protective personal equipment and other medical supplies. A testing campaign has resulted in more than 15 million tests being conducted across the continent to date. Nkengasong said that South Africa, which holds the rotating presidency of the African Union, convenes talks between heads of state and the Africa CDC once a month, and a campaign has recently been designed to coordinate how people in Africa travel through airports.
Put in more than 10,000 community healthcare workers, over 200 responders, that is epidemiologists, infection control people across multiple countries there. So I think for Africa, we've done the best with the limited resources that we have.
Emmanuel Agogo, country representative for Resolve to Save Lives, a team of global health experts aiding governments on their COVID-19 strategies, said in an interview that the reason for fewer deaths in Africa remained a mystery. But, he said, a younger demographic, the fact many of the first cases were constrained to wealthier people entering the continent via plane, and the high number of people using antiviral medicine could all have contributed. Agogo says a World Health Organization initiative of joint external evaluations, which helps countries to prevent, detect and respond to public health risks, bolstered the ability of governments to act quickly.
By doing that, they actually knew where the furniture was, so they knew the gaps in their preparedness, and they all developed national plans.
Agogo said that countries in Africa deserved kudos for implementing safety measures despite the economic fallout from doing so, and the Africa CDC had learned much from coordinating responses with the likes of Ebola in Congo and Lassa fever in Nigeria. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
COVID-19 restrictions have forced beaches to close near Australia's biggest city as scorching spring temperatures sent thousands of people to the coast. Beachgoers also were warned to stay away from Sydney's most famous arc of sand at Bondi as it neared capacity. Phil Mercer has more from Sydney.
Heading to the coast is a quintessential Australian pastime. But warmer weather in the southern hemisphere is testing the nation's plans to keep the coronavirus at bay. Visitor numbers are now limited, and two beaches south of Sydney were closed to avoid overcrowding. Swimmers also were told to avoid Bondi and Coogee, as thousands of people flocked to two of Sydney's most popular arcs of sand. COVID-19 marshals and the police have been on patrol to ensure people stayed a towel length apart. The authorities have said the public's response has been encouraging, but beachgoers have had mixed opinions about the safety measures.
I think it's pretty good. I think everyone's social distancing. So I think it's fine.
I'm absolutely outraged, to be honest. This is ridiculous. It's too many people. Yes, I am here as well and I'm going to go have a swim, but, you know, we shouldn't be, should we?
Australia has recorded about 27,000 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began and 900 people have died. Most states and territories have managed to contain the coronavirus. Queensland has reported no new infections in the past day. Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says the community is heeding hygiene and distancing advice.
Once again, I just want to congratulate Queenslanders for the great work that they have done. The results that we have had because of our health response has been because Queenslanders have listened. We have seen that time and time again, whether it's dealing with cyclones and natural disasters, whether it's dealing with bushfires. Queenslanders come together. It's an incredible story.
Lockdown measures, however, still apply in the city of Melbourne. Residents can only leave home for essential activities. Health officials there have said that restrictions will ease later this month if infection rates continue to fall. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Jordan's prime minister resigned earlier this week in line with preparations for next month's parliamentary elections. But observers say the government's recent handling of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout may have also led to Omar al-Razaz's resignation amid concerns about the country's stability as infection rates rise and a weekend lockdown looms. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Jordan's strict coronavirus lockdown and curfew measures ended in mid-June and only opened its main international airport on September 8. Then the small Middle Eastern kingdom saw scant COVID-19 cases, most by truckers transporting goods across borders or citizens returning home. But that positive picture has changed, although the more than 1,500 daily case rate is far smaller than those reported in the U.S. or Europe, it is worrisome for a country with limited intensive care beds and resources. It also hosts about 1.5 million refugees from regional conflicts, and COVID-19 has now been detected in refugee camps. The Jordanian government said this week the country's economy shrank 3.6% in the second quarter due to the pandemic, making it the sharpest economic contraction in two decades. Economists predict unemployment will hit 35% by year's end, its highest ever, according to the Jordan Economic Forum. Meanwhile, job losses and business closures are also impacting Jordan's middle class. This key U.S. ally lacks the oil wealth of its Gulf neighbors and is highly dependent on foreign aid. Jordanian analyst Labib Kamhawi tells VOA that reduced tax revenue and foreign remittances have also taken their toll.
The state is dependent almost 80% on its income from taxation. By virtue of the lockdown, the economy came to a halt and a lot of people suffered. Government had to issue decrees that allowed people not to pay taxes or to postpone payments. A lot of the income coming from expats has evaporated. Foreign aid is also diminishing, which means that on the whole, Jordan will not be able to make ends meet.
The UN Development Program told Reuters news agency that Jordan was already hit by years of sluggish growth and high unemployment, and now many families have little savings left to cope with income losses due to lockdown measures. Kamhawi says the country is fragile.
Jordan should be worried that peace and stability of the country might simply disappear under the pressure of need and economic failure. But because people are also afraid that what hit Syria, Libya, Yemen might hit Jordan if people take matters into their own hands.
Yet financial services company Standard & Poor's is maintaining the kingdom's stable B+ B ratings. It estimated a 75% drop in tourist receipts this year for the sector that provides 16% of Jordan's gross domestic product. Jordan has received more than $1.7 billion in grants and loans from Western donors so far, economists say, helping to ease a budget deficit expected to double this year to over 5% of GDP. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
The intense shelling in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh is taking its toll on the civilian population as fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces shows no sign of abating. Clashes in the region since September 27th have killed hundreds in the worst escalation of hostilities since 1994, when a truce ended a war that raged for years. Nagorno-Karabakh lies inside Azerbaijan, but has been under the control of ethnic Armenian forces backed by Armenia for more than a quarter century. Joining us now is Charles Means in Moscow. Charles, this appears to be a spiraling situation that's becoming increasingly more volatile and dangerous, particularly for civilians.
What we're hearing so far are these kind of different charges from both sides. Each one, Azerbaijan and Armenia, accusing the other of being the aggressor, of bombing into the other's territory, of missile strikes and things like that. We certainly know that the focus of this fight is around Nagorno-Karabakh. Bach, as you mentioned in your intro, this is this ethnically Armenian enclave inside Azerbaijan's borders. The two sides clashed over the territory in the early 90s and have repeatedly done so in smaller form over really the last 30 years. But it's just to give a sense of the scale of what this is about. I mean, the fighting back in the 90s killed 30,000 people, displaced over 1 million residents. That's before this shaky ceasefire was negotiated with key backing from the U.S., Russia, and France under a sort of a European peace process. But it's never really held, the ceasefire. You've had kind of skirmishes all along. What's different this time, and fighting broke out back on September 27th, what's different this time, you see Turkey entering the mix. Turkey is a regional power, of course. It's also backing Azerbaijan in this fight and really challenging Russia's, you know, one-time supremacy over the South Caucasus region in the process. And so that's what's making this so much bigger, in a sense, than just this fight that we've seen between Azerbaijan and Armenia over all these years.
It sounds like there's an increasing number of displaced civilians and a death toll that's mounting.
That's right. We're hearing from both sides that from sort of the military circles from both sides, from both countries, we hear about losses incurred through missile strikes, et cetera. None of these are confirmed. We don't really know. But when we talk to people on the ground who are in Nagorno-Karabakh, for example, these are aid workers, people from the Red Cross, for example, you know, they say that what they're seeing are civilians displaced, first of all, like in some of these cities around the conflict zone are all abandoned or more or less abandoned at this point. We've certainly heard of several hundred civilians killed. Unfortunately, we have this kind of info war going on, and it's very difficult for those of us monitoring this from afar to really know what's happening.
Is it safe to say that Russia is actually the nation that could potentially have the most influence on ending these disputes, or at least bringing this to dialogue? Or should the U.S. also be playing some sort of role?
Well, I think Russia plays the biggest role out of the traditional mediation effort that's been there. Again, over these last three decades, you have Russia, the U.S., and France leading this intermediation effort. What we're also seeing now is Russia has somewhat usurped its presence in the South Caucasus. It's not as strong as it used to be. There was a time kind of in the shadow of the Soviet Union where Moscow was always played the dominant role, where they could kind of snap their fingers and get people to listen. And it's not quite that simple these days. But Russia has a balancing act here to play as well. They have good relations with Azerbaijan. They're a military pact partner with Armenia. So in theory, they're allied with Armenia. But they sell weapons to both sides. And they're really most interested in trying to negotiate an end to the conflict, perhaps not even find an end to the conflict, but keep this a frozen conflict, which is what it's been for these past 30 years until this fighting broke out most recently. Also, Iran is another issue here. This just gets to just how thorny and complex the issue is around Nagorno-Karabakh, around Azerbaijan and Armenia, where if the Turks are backing Azerbaijan, well, Iran, which is Turkey's nemesis in the Middle East, is backing Armenia, although Armenia is Christian and Iran, of course, is not. So you have this very, very complex web of relationships going on, which have much to do about who's a rising regional power, who's the dominant power in the South Caucasus, and how do you kind of, and also, of course, between Muslims and Christians in that region, which, of course, is just carved up between the two sides. So it's made it for a really, really complex picture. And unfortunately, we've seen really no sense that these, even when we've had a ceasefire, it's been a tentative ceasefire and what they call a frozen conflict, not a peace.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have proposed that early Mars was warm with vast amounts of liquid water flowing across its surface. A trio of scientists released a new study in the journal Nature Geoscience that disputes this popular theory. Instead, they propose the red planet was covered with ice sheets and that its valleys, thought to have been formed from free-flowing liquid water, were carved by water melting beneath them. The authors examined more than 10,000 valleys on Mars to determine processes used to shape them. Noticing the similarities of the Martian valleys with channels of subglacial meltwater on islands of the Canadian Arctic Archipelago, they performed a comparative analysis. The researchers suggest their theory explains how valleys could have formed on a planet further from a weaker sun than Earth 3.8 billion years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. Of the many things that have changed since the coronavirus pandemic began is the way people work. Joining us now is Ramona Schindelheim, editor-in-chief of Working Nation, a bipartisan nonprofit campaign that seeks to raise awareness about the challenges workers and employers have been facing and will face in the future, potentially. Thanks so much for being with us. So first off, what has changed about the way people are working?
Well, the most obvious change probably is that those who could work remotely do. These are more knowledge-based, less physical labor-intensive jobs. Workers who can do their jobs online, like IT skills, cloud computing, data analytics, or interact with their customers online or by phone, are working from home. So it's safe health-wise, and it can actually save businesses money because they no longer need an office for all these workers.
Do you think that this has changed the perspective of workers and employers about what they can do at home? And have there been some unexpected benefits on either side or some negatives?
I think there has been some eye-opening for some businesses. So traditionally, we've all been people who go to offices no matter what our job is. And I don't think that businesses and the businesses that we've talked to, they acknowledge us. They have not thought about this idea of, oh, we could have people working from home. So that has made it more advantageous for the business owners, but it's also made it more advantageous for workers. They have a more flexible schedule. Some of the things that they might have had to take time off from to deal with or deal with on their lunch hours, they can work it into their schedule, especially if they're working remotely. There's a flip side of it, though, that your workday can become a blur. You know, you get maybe start your work earlier, you may end your work later. It just kind of all blends together because it's all part of your being right now.
I would think certainly, though, some workers feel that's given them a little bit more time back in their day.
Yeah, you don't have to get up and shower and drive to work and commute to work. But I think, though, in general, I think it's benefiting both sides in different ways. If you have a childcare issue, you know, if you have a young child who's going to school and maybe that school is now remotely, you can stay home with that child. That creates problems. On the other side, though, is how do you balance that work life at home where you really have no escape if you don't have the help there? So I have to say you get some time back, but I think your day is probably filled up, especially if you have young children.
I think also many employers may have been concerned that if they had employees working from home that they wouldn't work. I've talked to a lot of people that say they're working harder than they ever were.
Oh, I would say that is true. I mean, I'm looking at even what we're doing at Working Nation. Now the days are filled with a lot of Zoom calls or Skype calls or Microsoft Office, name the platform and you're on it. So it feels like the day has filled up quite a bit more and there is more productivity. For a job like ours, we are focused on the workforce. So this is a very busy time for us in general, but I feel like the day has definitely stretched from the beginning of the day to longer. So they're getting a lot more work out of everybody.
The other side of all of this is that, of course, the pandemic has led to many people losing jobs, many jobs lost, many businesses is no longer existing. Has that in and of itself potentially opened up new possibilities for people looking to make a change?
You know, I can't get inside the head of everyone, but there probably is a certain number of people out there who think that this is my job and this is what I'm going to do from now on. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic has probably made them rethink that. Whether it has created new opportunities that they have the skills to fill, that's a different question. For example, some of the jobs that might have gone away in retail or other service jobs, to be able to find a job that is career sustaining, family sustaining, you might need new skills. You might have to train. So if you can pay your bills and there are programs out there that you can take that are relatively inexpensive or for free through different nonprofits and some companies, and they will give you some of the skills that you need for these more knowledge-based jobs that actually do work remotely.
What is your organization doing to assist people looking to gain more skills and be more marketable in this world we're living in now?
Yeah, workingnation.com, that's our main website. We tell stories about programs that are out there that can help people get the skills they need. So there's a lot of articles there that might be useful. We also partner with different organizations to tell those stories. Recently, we just partnered with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on a series that tells stories about how people can upskill. So there are organizations out there who are trying to make sure people have the skills they need, and we are working with them to tell those stories.
Working Nation Editor-in-Chief Ramona Schindelheim, thanks so much for being with us. The parent company of the second largest movie theater chain in America is indefinitely closing all 536 U.S. locations as new movie releases are being postponed and people remain reluctant to go to theaters because of the coronavirus pandemic. Cineworld Group says it's closing Regal Cinemas in the U.S., along with 125 Cineworld and Picture House venues across Britain. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has details.
The Cineworld Group is indefinitely closing more than over 530 Regal movie theaters in the United States and about 125 venues in Britain. The move will affect 45,000 employees, says Chief Executive Mookie Gradinger.
I think that we reached a stage that we had no alternative. It's a very, very difficult decision for us, mainly in view of the move that we need to take towards the employees. It's not simple.
The group had shuttered its movie theaters after the coronavirus outbreak, but reopened back in July.
And really at the beginning, we got a very warm welcome from our customers. And we saw the people were missing the cinema. People want to go back to the cinema. But in a certain stage, we didn't have the goods.
That's because movie studios were postponing new releases like the latest James Bond movie.
James Bond.
So for now, it doesn't make sense to stay open, says the Cineworld chief.
We were in a kind of a situation that from liquidity point of view, we were bleeding much bigger amounts when we are open than when we are closed, because we'll be like a grocery shop with no food. And we had to take this decision.
Meanwhile, AMC Entertainment, the largest theater chain in the world, said on Tuesday most of its theaters in the U.S. and Europe will remain open. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And American singer Johnny Nash, known for the 1970s reggae hit I Can See Clearly Now, has died at the age of 80.
I can see clearly.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening and have a great day.